And we are going to bring you a very special edition of Taking Aim, a pre-produced edition of Taking Aim on the theme for which so many of you showed your support for this program during our fundraising drive, that theme being World War IV, material that Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen have put together that you have not yet heard. But first, to set us up on phone lines for a few minutes, we have the hosts and producers of Taking Aim, Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen.
Good afternoon, Matthew.
Good afternoon.
And WBAI listeners, this is
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We are broadcasting in full and uninterrupted, as Matthew mentioned, part three of our World War IV special. It continues our analysis of the bombings in Saudi Arabia and Kenya and the targeting of Iran and Syria. Remember, it is only one part of a significant program that provides perspective as well as detailed information about worldwide events unfolding today. While the WBAI Spring Fund Drive is over officially, you still have an opportunity to acquire your own copy of World War IV and to contribute to WBAI. Premiums such as World War IV are available all through this week. Now, World War IV is premium number 095. It's important to remember that. And for your contribution of $100 or more, it is our gift to you. Now, you can obtain it by sending an email to, now write this down, P-A-S-H-B-Y. That stands for Paul Ashby. P-Ashby at WBAI.org. And you mention 095, Taking Aim, World War IV. Give your name, address, phone number, your pledge amount, and, of course, your email address. Now, it's important to include your phone number because someone is going to call you back to so that you can give your credit card or electronic fund transfer information. If you want to send a check, you do so to WBAI Pacifica, 120 Wall Street, 10th floor, New York, New York, 10005. Ralph?
World War IV attempts to pull together the elements of the compelled adventurism of this ruling class, and it's amazing to me, really, when I start to consider the recent press reports that have been appearing in Great Britain and in the United States, in which people established and bourgeois economists and columnists have been commenting on the enormity of the lies that went into this fiction about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and how they're now being replicated with respect to Iran at the very moment that the Bush people with Democratic support are authorizing the use of nuclear weapons. And this intersecting with a crisis in the capitalist economy that really starts to take new departures, $44 trillion of budget deficit and the total elimination of the resources with which to develop any social services in the country. World War IV is about a crisis of capitalism resulting in disastrous consequences for humanity. And I believe that the devastating evidence that is increasingly recognized prepares us for the political fight back that is essential. And I don't mean another Democrat. I don't mean the evil lesser. But the building of a movement that can address the question of the need for revolutionary change in the United States. The political movement that challenges the systemic crisis that inflicts such misery and suffering and devastation on humanity. World War IV is about that subject. And we feel that the importance of WBAI and Pacifica in bringing this kind of information to the audience and to our public requires us to, if you like, fund pitch again and to take this opportunity again to urge people to buy the premium and to send in the support for the broadcasting at WBAI.
While it was President George Bush who, in his national security doctrine, talked about preemptive strikes, we found out in researching, doing the research for World War IV, that Secretary of State George Shultz the former Secretary of State, had articulated a policy of preemptive strikes long ago, in the late 1970s and mid-80s. And what he had said was, it's time to think long, hard, and seriously about the more active means of defense, defense through appropriate preemptive or preventative actions against terrorist groups before they strike. So here we see in the late 1970s, early 1980s, the administration, the U.S. rulers, the people in power representing the ruling class in the United States, they're already preparing to set up so-called terror groups and then to attack the terror groups, staging a series of actions for permanent war.
Well, you know, I think as we've continually tried to discuss in the fall and in analyzing the false category of terror, the ideological barrage with which our people have been overwhelmed about terror. What this is the continuation of imperial policy of providing a lying pretext for war and repression. And what's distinctive about the period in the late 70s when the neocons and the liquidization of policy that is reflected in the embrace of the Israeli strategy of breaking up each state into its ethnic and religious components unfolded, is that what we're really witnessing here is the surfacing and explicit advocacy of what had been done without acknowledgement in all the previous wars of predation that imperialism has launched. Pretext for war, blaming the victim, has been always the means through which our people have been confused and overwhelmed with lies to justify war and repression. That's what is concentrating itself now in the open acknowledgement of this as the modus operandi of imperialism.
So that you can hear the full part three, we're now going to go to the program. Remember, you can obtain your copy of World War IV by contacting WBAI at PASHBY@WBAI.org. And it's 095 Taking Aim World War IV. Now, we'll be with you next week, and if you have any comments or questions, please call us at 212-209-2953, or you can reach us at takingaim@pacbell.net.
And in listening to World War IV, keep this in mind. When an operative of the Central Intelligence Agency bombs the embassy in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, when operatives of the FBI and the CIA are involved in the events of 9/11 and the planning of 9/11 and its implementation as they were in 1993. When indeed the operatives of the Central Intelligence Agency and the military prepare us for acts of war against country after country, acts for which the pretexts are staged by these very operatives, keep in mind this is the way capitalism maintains itself in power. This is the way the public is whipsawed into support for policies that are not in their own interests. It is the little continuation of the nature of class rule, and I emphasize this because what we are doing here is preparing for the fight back, for the understanding that will build a political resistance, a political movement, a political party that is based upon revolutionary change and then a transformation of the economic and political system in capitalist society.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you with part three of World War IV, our special on May 20th, 2003. We had been speaking about the so-called terrorist attacks in Saudi Arabia and in Morocco, with many more to come, as we are told. But also we were speaking about past attacks, particularly in Kenya in 2002 and in 1998. Ralph?
The Washington Post, Maya, on May 17th ran a story called Marines Comb Borders as Worries Rise in Kenya. U.S. and British Marines today combed Kenya's borders with Somalia and Sudan and monitored Western targets here in the capital as fears of an attack by a suspected al-Qaeda operative caused nervousness at airports, embassies, and foreign residents. In Nairobi, home to more than 50,000 Westerners, U.S. Marines in plain clothes can be seen in the vicinity of embassies and so-called soft targets. More than 1,800 U.S. troops are operating in the Horn of Africa as part of a special anti-terrorism task force. This, indeed, are the special operation forces that are basically assassination and killer squads. And late today, the British government warned, quote, of a clear terrorist threat in Kenya, Ethiopia, Tanzania, Somalia, Eritrea, and Djibouti. And indeed, these attacks are keyed as well to the bombing of the two U.S. embassies in East Africa, the Washington Post continues, in 1998, and with the attacks in Gaza on November 28, 2002. They are preparing us, and indeed some of these apparatuses are supposed to be preparing attacks within the United States as well, as we are being set up for A series of events in Kenya. Let us examine what has occurred in the past.
Ralph, before we do that, I want to remind people that Vice President Dick Cheney, at a seminal speech before the Veterans of Foreign Wars 103rd National Convention, August 6, 2002, spoke about the long-term war in which the U.S. rulers are engaged and in which they would have us submit to this long-term battle, and why they were doing it. These supposed terrorist attacks, which we are showing, are actually staged and orchestrated by U.S. rulers and their compatriots in the Israeli Mossad themselves. As Vice President Cheney said, "Wars are never won on the defensive. We must take the battle to the enemy. We are still closer to the beginning of this war than we are to its end. The United States has entered a struggle of years, a new kind of war, against a new kind of enemy. They hide in many countries. There is no doubt they wish to strike again." He's referring to the attack after September 11th. "And that they are working to acquire the deadliest of all weapons. We must find them where they dwell, stop them in their planning, and one by one bring them to justice." The rationale for World War IV. Ralph.
Maya, there are several things to say about this. In 1998, these attacks, which led to the death of 210 people and 100 others missing and feared dead in the rubble of the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, with over 5,000 people injured in the twin blasts, the vast majority in Nairobi. We are told, and we are, as we have mentioned just prior to this, the role of a high-level CIA FBI operative who had not only been the organizer of the attacks on these embassies while he was an operative of the CIA and the FBI, but had, was organizing the bodyguards of Osama bin Laden while he was an operative of the CIA and FBI, as the article in the San Francisco Chronicle documented. But now we are finding that Haaretz and ABC News reported at that very time that a U.S. informant in Kenya had warned the American government 2 weeks before the blast of the specific targeting of the Nairobi embassy. And indeed, the articles that spell this out were in Haaretz and in the Australian press.
Ralph, the article in Haaretz, which appeared on August 12, 1998, was written by Eldar Akiva, Horowitz Nitzan, and Harald Amos. In fact, Israeli intelligence warned the United States that the embassy in Kenya would be the target of a bombing, and this they did shortly before the attack occurred. Israeli intelligence, however, said, "Don't put too much faith in this report."
In other words, what we have here,
they wanted it to go forward. And then the Nation, which is Kenya's, according to ours, Kenya's most reliable newspaper, also said that a security guard working near the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi also issued a warning. He had seen someone with a video camera. He observed them immediately afterward take off in a car, and he told the embassy guards what he had seen, and he said they appeared uninterested. And the CIA, according to Aritz, claimed that it had prevented two other embassy attacks in recent years. Really?
The office of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu refused to comment on the Haaretz article, indicating that a single operative of Israeli intelligence alerted to the attacks had warned U.S. Intelligence services, only to have the Mossad immediately countermand this and instruct the U.S. to ignore this warning. That is what Haaretz reveals. And the second warning, provided 4 days before the explosion, as reported in the Nairobi Nation, spells out that security guards saw a man videotaping the building, protected by bodyguards, and it goes into the particulars about how this, too, was not acted upon. And ABC News reports that all American facilities in the Middle East and South Asia had been put on security alert against a specific attack, but no security measures were ordered for the Nairobi and Dar es Salaam embassies, even though they were specified as the potential and anticipated targets of the attacks.
What we are demonstrating is that this is not a matter of incompetence. This is a matter of forethought. This is a matter of planning.
Foreknowledge and standing down. Here's the Sydney Morning Herald on in Kenya. With respect to the attacks which occurred in Mombasa, well, is this not familiar? The headline is Early Warning on Kenya.
And the date is November 30th, 2002.
Australia posted a strong and specific warning about a terrorist attack in Kenya in Mombasa 16 days before this week's bombing and missile assault in Mombasa. The warning, the strongest of any country, was based on Australian intelligence that these bombing and missile assaults were in preparation. It was issued on November 12th against the specific sites in Nairobi and Mombasa, and it urged its own nationals to avoid the hotels, clubs, bars, schools, and places of worship that were targeted. The Israeli military said yesterday that it also acknowledged the fact that there was prior knowledge. The specter that Israeli spy agency Mossad may have had an involvement is raised in the Sydney Morning Herald as well. Foreknowledge, Mossad foreknowledge of the November 28, 2002 Mombasa attacks. The Australian warning is very, very specific, and indeed Germany also received the warning and took it seriously enough to instruct its citizens to avoid those sites. Initially, Israeli government spokesman denied that the warning had been received, but 4 days after the blast, Brigadier General Yossi Kupfwasser admitted that Israeli military intelligence had prior knowledge of the attack. Specific enough that Danny Yatom, the former Mossad head, took a similar line in which he acknowledged that the report of the pending attacks had been received, but dismissed it because he said they get too many terror warnings and they weren't taking them seriously. Warning fatigue is hardly a convincing excuse for the Mossad. The Israeli government put its own citizens in harm's way. These attacks took place against a background of high-level Western military activity in the region. U.S. forces engaged in exercise in the Kenyan military north of Mombasa. The Central Intelligence Agency, operating at the time with a base at Mombasa Airport, providing logistical support to Kenyan security forces, the German Air Force patrolling the skies off Mombasa at the very time of the attack, a Western military presence in Djibouti and the Horn of Africa and the whole east coast of Africa under alert notice at the time of the attacks. These attacks were not merely not prevented. They were orchestrated and protected, a staged operation, as the press reports, early warnings on Kenya in 2002. The modus operandi is explicit and clear.
As the Sydney Morning Herald reported May 19th, Al-Qaeda serpent growing new heads, in an article by David Johnson and Don Van Natta in Washington. It's a reprint of an article from the New York Times and the Washington Post. As you can see, the press throughout the world is spreading the mythology of Al-Qaeda serpent growing new heads, a mythology that is important in order to sell U.S. intervention. In a speech delivered by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld before the Senate Armed Services Committee in September of 2002. Now, this was testimony that he gave to present the big lie, the rationale for the invasion of Iraq. But in it, he sets forth how they are going to sell intervention worldwide. In fact, it's become his mantra. He stated, quote, "Today we must decide whether the risks of acting are greater than the risk of not acting. Do the risks of taking action to stop that threat outweigh the risks of living in the world as we see it evolving? Or is the risk of doing nothing greater than the risk of acting?" He says, "Mr. Chairman, each of us has a responsibility to do everything in our power to ensure that when the history of this period is written, the books won't ask why we slept. Why we slept. As they stage terror attacks throughout the world, and we have seen Kenya, Saudi Arabia, Morocco, what next? What next is the question on the minds of many people. But when they ask what next, they're not asking where will terror groups strike next. They are asking what country is the United States going to attack covertly or overtly with troops next."
Well, let us examine that question, because not only is what next relevant to what happens within the frontiers of the United States, but the events that we are describing in Kenya take place within a very specific context. An article by Jim Loeb in the Interpress Service News Agency on May 9th makes things clear. U.S. military footprint looms larger in Africa. Africa getting more attention from the Pentagon as the U.S. military makes major geostrategic shifts in its global deployments. The Defense Department has made no formal announcement about U.S. plans to acquire base rights throughout the African mainland, but their moves suggest interest in moving quickly towards that end. On Thursday, the Department announced the U.S. counterterrorism warship, the USS Mount Whitney, is returning home from its tour off the coast of the Horn of Africa, but not before leaving off its command personnel and equipment at Camp Lemonnier in Djibouti, which is the main U.S. base for counter-terrorist activity offshore and in the region. Mount Whitney's departure means that Camp Lemonnier will now be home to 1,600 U.S. troops, sailors, flyers, and civilian personnel at a highly strategic point between Ethiopia and Somalia across the Red Sea from Yemen. So we have, as the article describes, a little noticed remark by NATO Supreme Commander U.S. General James Jones that Washington plans to boost a major troop presence in West Africa that provides more than 15% of all U.S. oil imports, a percentage slated to rise to 25% within 12 years. The carrier battleships of the future and the expeditionary strike groups of the future may not spend 6 months in the Mediterranean Sea. They will spend half their time on the west coast of Africa, Jones told the Defense Writers Group breakfast in late April. The context for these staged events in Kenya, the warnings that they are now being put forth, the record of high-level CIA FBI operatives in the bombing of the embassies in Nairobi and in Dar es Salaam, the role of the Mossad and the CIA in the events of 2002, not only in the Australian press, but in Haaretz itself? Is the documentation explicit and clear? The state terror of imperialism and Zionist colony instrument, the vehicle for preemptive war, for permanent war, for the terrorizing of the American people and the peoples of the world.
Not only in the Middle East, as we see now throughout Africa and onto Asia. Who's next? What next? And who's next? The question on everyone's mind. And let's look specifically now at Syria and Iran. We touched on Iran a little bit when we talked about the support of Ladine and the other neocons for the Shah's son and the organization that he had set up. The fact that Republican Senator Sam Brownback and Democratic Representative Tom Lantos from California have supported legislation, $50 million annually, to support the Iran Democracy Foundation, which would have broadcasting to Iran. Now, what's interesting is that some of this is already going on with destabilization of Iran. And this is the CIA. One has an undercover unit in East Iran, as reported by DEPCA. And the CIA undercover unit was reported on September 26, 2002. It entered Iran through Zabul in Sistan, how do you say it, Ralph?
I'm sorry?
The Baluchi people. Was it Balustan?
Oh, no, Baluchistan, Maya.
Baluchistan.
Which is Iran is a multicultural nation. The Farsi or the Persian population are not quite 50% of the population. You have the Azerbaijani Turks in Tabriz, and in the north you have the substantial Kurdish population. You have the 6 million Arab minority in the oil-producing province of Khuzestan. You have the Turkmeni people, but in particular the Baluchi population of the eastern part of Iran bordering Pakistan. In fact, Baluchi independence has been a burning issue like that of Kurdish independence, because the Baluchi people are arbitrarily divided between Pakistan and Iran, and Baluchi subordination has been the policy of the Shah of Iran and of counter-revolutionary regimes imposed by the United States.
Well, just as we've seen now, the destabilization in Saudi Arabia with the attacks against the Saudi royal family, the assassination attempts, and the recent attacks against the compounds where the American Vanel trainers of the Saudi royal family's National Guard reside, as well as Bechtel employees and other company employees. Now we have the CIA undercover units going into Baluchistan, and the CIA finds it strategic in two ways, very significant ways, as you're explaining, Ralph, in order to lead to the breakup of Iran. If they can't effect a change, what they call regime change, then they want to dismantle the country, break it up into easily managed segments. And the Baluchistan happens to be the most impoverished section of Iran. So that is where the CIA is targeting, and as you say, it's close to Pakistan, so that is an easy point of entry for the CIA special units.
Maya, you were reporting earlier about the central role of Michael Ladine and the preparations to create the monarchy with the son of the Shah, the grandson of the syphilitic corporal, who was the British instrument for the arbitrarily appointed a Shah, as he carried out a brutal series of genocidal onslaughts for British imperialism, attacking the Turkmeni and the Azerbaijani Turks and the Kurds and the Baluchi and the peoples of Mashhad in the northeast at the time. Here in the Financial Times on May 9, 2003, united by their desire for regime change in Iran, encouraged by the overthrow of the Iraqi regime, Iranian monarchists have developed a strategic alliance with in Washington with the neoconservatives and in the Pentagon and Israeli groups. Supporters of Reza Pahlavi, the Virginia-based son of the last Shah of Iran, sees a role model in Ahmed Chalabi, head of the Iraqi National Congress, backed by powerful figures in the Pentagon. The American Enterprise Institute, the conservative think tank that hosted the Iranian conference this week, is home to the analysts who pushed the Pahlavi cause as they did that of Chalabi. Michael Ledeen of American Enterprise Institute has stated that Pahlavi was the suitable leader for the transition in Iran. And not only is it the architectural plan of the American Enterprise Institute and of Michael Ledeen, but JINSA itself, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, is taking the lead in preparing for the assault on Iran. Douglas Feith, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, according to administration insiders, will be the point man along with Ledeen for this operation. And Donald Rumsfeld, as the Financial Times further reports in its article called Pentagon Hawks Woo Iranian Exiles, Donald Rumsfeld stated that the alignment of interests for a regime change in neighboring Iran are in place. The U.S. military has forged a deal with militants in eastern Iran, allowing to keep weapons and uniforms weeks before U.S. bombers had been in place to carry out attacks. We see the preparations for the attack on Iran well in place.
I was mentioning the CIA undercover units, and we mentioned the broadcasting facilities, but also a group of 50 ex-Iranians, in other words, people living in the United States, actually resident in California, were selected by the Interviewing Service of America, Inc., a sort of telemarketing, covert action telemarketing company, to run day-long telephone campaigns to private citizens and companies in Iran in order to solicit real-time information on current events, so-called, according to DEPCA in this September 26th article. And in an article by Jim Loeb in Foreign Policy in Focus called From Baghdad to Tehran, he asks with a question mark, but actually what he's talking about is from Baghdad to Tehran without a question mark, because he talks about the writings of William Kristol in the Evening Standard. William Kristol, one of the founders of the Project for the New American Century, whose policy document in 2000 became the national security strategy, almost line by line, for the United States. And William Kristol and the other neoconservatives have been calling for covert action against Tehran. And what we have been describing here is the covert action, some of it rather overt, that is taking place already against the Iranian government.
The propaganda machine for permanent war is in high gear. The Associated Press and ABC News reported on May 15th that an Iranian group states that Tehran has bioweapons. Representatives of the National Council of Resistance of Iran stated that the Iranian government has positioned itself to use anthrax, plague, and other poisons and diseases. Now, the Iranian Council of Resistance is none other than the CIA construct of Michael Ledeen and the neocons allied with the Pahlavis. The officials with the, quote, resistance movement specified labs, companies, military organizations, and leaders in Iran that they claim are involved in producing germs and anthrax and bioweapons for attack. And here on the 16th of May in The Guardian in London, U.S. accuses Iran of stockpiling chemical arms. Once again, the putative weapons of mass destruction monopolized by the United States are the subject of accusation. Quote, Washington is accusing Tehran of stockpiling nerve agents, pursuing a chemical weapons program, while Iran has aggressive bioweapons efforts underway. The Bush administration has accused Iran of building a nuclear bomb chemical and biological weapons programs of stockpiling blister, blood, and choking agents and nerve agents, U.S. diplomat Stephen Rademacher said in a statement obtained by The Guardian. The statement was read out to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons at a meeting in The Hague. Iran vehemently denies the allegations and states that they are sheer propaganda. But Washington has now stated that Tehran is producing weaponized anthrax and actively working with five other pathogens, including smallpox, in building an arsenal of biological weapons. The fix is in.
That's right. This is a redux, a repeat of what we saw to rationalize the assault against the people of Iraq. As William Crystal wrote, remember, the editor of the Evening Standard, the Rupert Murdoch publication, quote, Iran is the tipping point in the war on proliferation, the war on terror, and the effort to reshape the Middle East. If Iran goes pro-Western and anti-terror, positive changes in Syria and Saudi Arabia will follow much more easily. Now, the Iranians recognize this, and they believe that it is Israel that has put forward Iran as the specific next target. But if you read the Israeli press and the statements of Ariel Sharon, you can see that they can't actually tell who is next, whether it's Syria, Iran, or Saudi Arabia. So, in fact, they are trying for all of them at once. The Supreme Council for National Security, the Secretary General of it, Hassan Rouhani, warned in comments March 15th, quote, after Iraq, the U.S. administration plans to wage a media war against Iran, involving killing people's beliefs and changing their behavior to damage and destroy our national unity and the people's religious and national identity. That is the statement of Hassan Rouhani, the Secretary General of the Supreme Council for National Security in Iran. Everyone is aware that what we hear and what we see coming throughout the media, except for, of course, our Pacifica stations, is exactly the U.S. position as articulated first from the conferences against terror in the late 1970s and mid-80s, attended by George Bush Sr., and George Shultz, Michael Ledeen, James Woolsey, and many others, but particularly by members of the press, such as Ted Koppel, Bob Woodward, Arnaud de Borsgrave, and others.
Maya.
And here we see it playing out, once again, after Iraq, now with Iran, and also Syria.
And let us be very clear, when it comes to the broadcasting that we do on WBAI and our co-producers on Pacifica, this is not a question of the Bushmen. This is not a question of the neocons. These are policies that are fully supported by the entire security apparatus. Woolsey was a key Democratic figure, the security man for Bill Clinton, the head of the CIA for Bill Clinton. Campbellman and these people have gone back to Hubert Humphrey, Lyndon Johnson, even John F. Kennedy, and Jimmy Carter. It is the one big property party with two names. And here in the World Tribune on April 4th, what's next? U.S. sets sights on Iran and North Korea. The Bush administration has pledged to end the nuclear weapons programs in Iran and North Korea after concluding its campaign against the Iraqi regime of Saddam Hussein. Administration officials stated that the White House has targeted the nuclear programs in Iran and North Korea as the next imminent threats. Quote, in the aftermath of Iraq, addressing Iranian nuclear weapons is of equal importance as dealing with the North Korean nuclear weapons program, Assistant Secretary of State John Bolton stated. He told a conference of the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, APEC, that the Iranian nuclear weapons program is receiving extremely high priority under the Bush administration, Middle East Newsline reported. He stated that Iran is steadily advancing towards nuclear weapons capability, a development confirmed by the International Atomic Energy Agency. The estimate we now of how close the Iranians are to production grows closer each day. We are stunned by the sophistication of the Iranian effort, and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice sounded the alarm. Iran is regarded as a rogue regime and under close examination for immediate action by Washington, Rice states, sometimes people think we're a little bit the sky is falling on these regimes that are called the axis of evil. But when we have a better atmosphere after Iraq, we're going to look at how we go after this and deal with these issues and these weapons of mass destruction in Iran and in North Korea.
Each in their turn, Ralph. You were talking about John Bolton, the U.S. Undersecretary of State and the disarmament expert. Now, he also, you were talking about Iran, May 7th, 2002, last year, U.S. warned Syria of its ties with terror groups was an article in Debka. Now, on May 6th, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, this is 2002, a year ago, visited the Pentagon. And on the same day as Sharon's visit to the Pentagon, John Bolton, the very man you were speaking of, who was accusing Iran of nuclear weapons, he accused Libya, Syria, and Cuba of pursuing weapons of mass destruction. So here we have Bolton. And then he said of Syria, quote, "We are concerned about Syria's advances with CW, chemical weapons, its infrastructure, and believe that Syria is pursuing development of biological weapons and is able to produce at least small amounts of biological warfare agents."
Maya, just as you are reporting, it's very interesting to note that Condoleezza Rice, was coupling Iran and North Korea as priority targets. Here we have the Press Trust of India on May 15th, U.S. to toughen stand on North Korea and Syria, Condoleezza Rice. The U.S. has given clear signals it is going to follow through on tough policies in dealing with Iran, Syria, and North Korea. Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, told reporters that Iran and Syria engage in behavior antithetical to American interests. She cites the nuclear program in Iran, but she states that Iran is only one of the chief sponsors of terrorism. Hezbollah is operating out of Iran, but with Syrian support. The Washington-Damascus relationship is problematic. She specifies Syrian support for terrorism and Hezbollah along with Iran. And she states that U.S. policy is that the occupation of Lebanon, by which she means Syrian assistance to Hezbollah, which is the resistance movement that drove out the Israeli occupiers of Lebanon, that this is linked to Syrian weapons of mass destruction, for which the United States has targeted Syria. Now, the Syrian regime has made every effort to back the U.S. off, mainly by conceding to demands and closing the offices of Hezbollah and Palestinian organizations in Damascus. It will be to no avail any more than admitting inspectors in Iraq had any impact on the predetermined plans of preemptive war policymakers in Washington.
Now, we have spoken of the role of the press in all this, of establishing the drumbeat towards war. The New York Times, April 15th, a month ago, "The Road to Damascus" was an editorial. Quote, "The Bush administration is right to be alarmed and angry about Syria. There is reason to believe that both military equipment and potential suicide bombers have been sent from Syria for use in Iraq against American troops. Now, American officials are convinced that Syria is permitting Saddam Hussein's top lieutenants to escape across its border. As the United States begins to exercise its new role as godparent of a new, freer government in Iraq, it will have to figure out how to handle many hostile neighbors, starting with Syria." And then, Syria, he goes on with the drumbeat, "has long given refuge to anti-Israel terror groups like the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. It may also have an active chemical weapons program."
So, Maya, this is the leitmotif, the Daily Telegraph. "Syria is the top U.S. target for regime change." This is August 4th of 2003, August 4th, much before the...
2002, it can't be. You mean it's April...
No. Excuse me, I am
it's
absolutely...
It's April 8th.
Yes, not August 4th, but April 8th. It's 8-4 in the British usage. They put the month first, excuse me, listeners. Yes, you're quite right. April 8th, 2003, Syria target is the top U.S. Target for regime change in the Daily Telegraph, Toby Harden in Washington. The main subject on the agenda of the Belfast summit yesterday is Syria, the Pentagon's next likely target for regime change, as it has allowed Saddam Hussein to transfer his weapons of mass destruction within Syrian borders. And it goes into a detailed, delineated plan, a timetable for the removal of the regime.
And
on April 14th, the London Times confirms U.S. Syria tells Syria to cooperate and to acquiesce in U.S. demands or to face U.S. military action.
You had one after another U.S. officials sending out threats to Syria, and the U.S. media and the media internationally establishing this drumbeat so people of the United States would believe the proliferation of these lies. Then you also had Hosni Mubarak, the Egyptian president, and other emissaries, diplomatic and covert, from the Arab states, who went to Syria and spoke with Syrian President Bashar Assad, warning him of what would take place, the consequences, if he did not have clear concessions in response to the United States. And one of the demands was that he turn over Iraqi officials who may have gone to Syria. Now, what's interesting is that they kept on naming Iraqi officials that were later found in Iraq. But Bashar Assad said that he would not, in Syria, allow the Iraqi officials to find refuge in Syria. They also put out word that Syria had the so-called weapons of mass destruction, that they had been transported from Iraq to Syria. Now, what's interesting is that while the Bush administration, in the auspices of Colin Powell and President Bush himself, were making these statements, General Tommy Franks came on record and said there was no evidence of this movement of these weapons of mass destruction. And they were caught in a bind. And back and forth, this went on for several weeks. And the United States still is continuing saying that Syria is not only harboring the Iraqi officials, but it still is containing these weapons of mass destruction. They are trying to explain why they are not finding any in Iraq.
And as they beat the drums of war to destabilize and to remove the governments of Syria and Iran and to fragment each country in its turn and to seize its resources, the roadmap of the real roadmap of the preemptive war, within Palestine, the series of occupations that the Zionist government has undertaken have affected what Haaretz calls the beginning of real transfer. They have seized the West Bank. They have seized Gaza. The economy of the Palestinian remnant economy in the West Bank is totally destroyed. Bethlehem is a ghost town. Shops are shut down. The means of sustenance are eliminated. The population is without the means of support. And indeed, as this occurs, and the so-called road map is presented, the headline in Spacewar is, "The Jerusalem blasts hammer the last nail in the road map coffin. The latest string of Palestinian attacks, has shattered the slim hopes arising from the road map for peace. The so-called road map for peace, a road map for the Bantustanization, which the Sharon regime has no intention of permitting, is being put into deep freeze on the basis of the bombing attacks." And we should keep in mind, not only was the Mossad involved in the with Saudi intelligence in the formation of Hamas, But the Haaretz report that in Gaza, a so-called Al-Qaeda unit was found to it by the Palestinians and documented to have been a Mossad apparatus presenting itself as that of Al-Qaeda. And indeed, the distinction may be Aesopian, if it exists at all. Jerusalem blasts hammer last nail in roadmap coffin. And what do we find the Zionists preparing? Gordon Thomas reports on May 16th, 34 of Mossad's killing machine come to Britain. Israel's Mossad has gone into Great Britain. The Israeli intelligence agency has sent members of its Kidon assassination squads to join 15 other hand-picked katzas, its relentless field agents. Their brief is to disable close to 50 British Muslim leaders in Great Britain. The Mossad has sent its own termination squad. An MI5 official stated, "We know from past experience that the Kidon makes murder look like an accident. It is their specialty," unquote. Terror apparatus, indeed. The state terror of imperialism, the state terror of the Zionist colonial settler regime, victimizing the peoples and imputing to them the behavior of the imperial regimes themselves.
And while this is going on, the Israeli ambassador in Washington called for, quote, regime change in Iran and Syria on Monday, April 28th. He recommended diplomatic isolation, economic sanctions, and what he called psychological pressure. This was reported in Reuters. Ambassador Daniel Ayalon said the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the overthrow of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein helped create great opportunities for Israel, but it was, quote, not enough. It has to follow through. We still have great threats of that magnitude coming from Syria and coming from Iran, he told a conference of the pro-Israeli Anti-Defamation League. And with the isolation of Iran that he proposes, the isolation of Syria, this is what we have unfolding.
From Iran and Syria, and then to Libya and Saudi Arabia and Egypt yet to come. But while they are talking about Iran and Syria, they are beating the drums of war in North Korea itself. In North Korea, where indeed the equipment and the facilities for the electrical power and the sustaining of the agricultural production in Korea was supposed to be supplied by none other than a company of Donald Rumsfeld. Donald Rumsfeld, $250 million of profit to be derived from this, and then they renege. They get the money, and then they renege. And when the North Koreans attempt to operate their nuclear facilities, they are accused of preparing them for nuclear bombs. In fact, the North Koreans have stated explicitly their primary objective is to provide an energy source to facilitate their food production and distribution, on which the U.S. government had reneged.
What's interesting, Ralph, about this is that on March 20th of this year, the Washington Post, in an article, North Korea Stymied on Plutonium Work, revealed that this very nuclear reactor has 1950s technology, and it would require a significant amount of hands-on operation that is normally done by remote controls in other countries, and that the United States, in talking about the North Korean capabilities, is comparing it to what a production plant would be like in the United States with modern technology, and that North Korea doesn't have the capabilities for which the United States is accusing it of having.
What we are facing and confronting here is the standard litany of weapons of mass destruction, an impoverished country, a country blockaded, a country starved out, notwithstanding the Stalinist regime in North Korea. The imperialists have never been concerned about the fact of the question of repression. There is not a dictatorial regime, a repressive regime in the world that has not been supported and sustained by the United States imperialists, that has not been an instrument from Panama to Iraq, from the Shah of Iran to the military regime in Turkey, to the Banana Republic guerrillas across Latin America. It is the hallmark of imperialism. It is the pretext that they are objecting to repression on the part of those regimes that they cannot dominate, that they use as the vehicle for attack.
And we've been speaking about the prophets of war, those who espouse war. And in the next section, we will talk about the prophets with an I, the money-making aspect of war, and what this means for the extreme crisis of capitalism and how they expect to make these profits off our backs.
And you are listening to WBAI New York, Taking Aim, with Maya Schoen and Ralph Sherman, WBAI in New York. Let's see, we are experiencing a little trouble here. Okay. Here we go. That was World War IV with Maya Schoen and Ralph Sherman. Stay tuned to WBAI. At 6 o'clock, we will be bringing you the local news, and at 6:30, Free Speech Radio News. Tune in next week at 5 o'clock for more of Taking Aim, World War IV, and more from Ralph Sherman and Maya Schoen.